following program is paid for by Little John Financial Services. The opinions and views expressed may not reflect those of Brook Communications, its affiliates, or its employees.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4. Every weekday, News Radio 1240 KQEN brings you local information at 4 o'clock. Now it's True Wealth, presented by Little John Financial Services. Here is David Littlejohn with True Wealth on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
All right, gang, you know what time it is. It is the best Tuesday you've had all week. It is time for the True Wealth Radio Show. Dave Littlejohn joining me in studio today.
Matt Dixon.
All right, and we are ready to rock. First, let me go formally on the record as no, not interested in the fantasy football draft.
Oh, man, I'm going to keep twisting your arm until
He is trying. You know, we're going to talk a little bit today on the show about sort of how like the risk analysis and the numbers. Like I'm kind of, this is a by the numbers show, not boring by the numbers, but it's hilarious to me because I got to give you the backdrop, everybody. If you were to, you know, so right before the show, I'm talking to Matt about the concept of diminishing marginal return. Right. And I tell him, I have this theory called the B plus second draft rule. And he springs into action and says to me, right, I got an A plus on my draft.
Yeah.
Which my eyes like roll back in my head. And I go, I don't even know what this means.
My draft grade was phenomenal. I had the 12th pick in the draft this year for fantasy football and scored an A plus on the draft rating.
All right. I got to know, how much time do you invest in fantasy football?
It's really bad. It takes a toll on my marriage in the fall. My wife hates it, but it's addicting.
So there are a couple of things I'm learning about Matthew. So one of them is this bizarre fetish for fantasy football.
Yep.
And fishing lures.
Yeah.
Right? Like, and not, well, just fishing in general, right?
Fishing lures. Yeah. Obsessed.
You like make your own fishing lures, don't you?
Oh, yeah.
This is a subtle plug. Like, you can buy fishing lures from Matt.
Yeah, you just go to Waldron's. We've got hats. We've got fishing lures, T-shirts.
I see.
It's a full-on production.
I see. What we decided we were going to make T-shirts last time for something. Now I got to remember what the phrase was.
It had something to do with capitalism.
Ethical capitalism.
Yes, ethical capitalism.
We're going to do, hashtag ethical capitalism. We're going to have that as our T-shirt line.
We should give them out to customers as they come in.
Oh, I really love the idea. And it is totally relevant today. But so we're going to talk a little bit about just how one goes about analyzing numbers. Now, why is this even coming up? There's context, okay? So let me first share a little bit about, as you all know, we talk about all kinds of things in the financial arena. When this show first started, and it's been years now.
When did it start?
It's been like 6 years ago, something like that.
Five, six years ago. So you're a legend now.
No.
Oh.
That's not accurate at all. What happened was, so years ago, there was a gentleman by the name of Kelly Leonard who did, I don't remember what it was called, but like I think it was called It's Your Money or something like that.
Okay.
But anyway, so he did this show for years. And then when he was getting ready to sort of, I'll call it retire, right? I don't know if you ever really retire from finance.
Phase out.
But he was going to phase out. And nobody else wanted the job, evidently.
Really?
No, not really, really. I was sort of asked about it. Now, because we're not in a brokerage environment, a little bit more flexibility with the rules. Because financial advisors aren't selling stuff. They sell advice. And it's fiduciary in nature. It is more complicated in terms of the rules and regulations around advertising. Now, it says right at the beginning of the show, right? Hey, this is paid for by Little John Financial. So it is technically an advertisement. But our take has always been this is about education, right? So we don't sell much on this show. And the tagline from the start was True Wealth is it's the stuff money can't buy and death can't take away, right? So it's the memories and the relationships. That's the real wealth in our world. The rest of it is just money's how you trade your time.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So we talk about it a lot. And we tell folks that are listening, look, if you find yourself over your head, find somebody to help. And if you don't have that somebody, it maybe is us. Right? So it is an advertisement, but it's pretty loose.
Yeah.
Well, I told you that story to, you know, kind of get to the punchline of underneath the hood of what we do, we manage money for customers.
And we educate them along the way.
We do. But on the show, we educate a lot. But, I mean, if you go to Little John Financial, one of the things we do is, you know, there's financial planning and strategy and a bunch of things. But some of it is we manage money. Now, that means in some environments, financial planners and advisors will introduce to third-party firms, mutual funds and so forth. Now, there's nothing wrong with using mutual funds. We do it too. But a lot of the time, we build our own investment strategies, right? So we actually go out and buy the individual stocks. And it's the equivalent of sort of creating your own private mutual fund.
Yeah,
right?
That's a good way to
say it. It's not
a
mutual fund because it's not other people, right? But you have your own private fund that mimics what a mutual fund would be doing. But you own it. You control the taxes and all those elements that come with it. And we have different strategies that we use for different purposes and different investors. And we were talking about a dividend investment model that we have.
Yeah.
So one of the models that we have typically holds 25 investments in it by design. And we want to own fewer than that. I know this sounds crazy, right? Like, wait a minute, you want to be less diversified? So mathematically, it's justifiable. We're not going to talk about it on the show today, but you know, the standard deviation doesn't change that much if we reduce the number of positions. And we want to pair it with another strategy or two or three, right? So there will be more positions when we mix them all together, but we were shopping for dividends.
We did spend some time today doing that.
Yeah. And so I sort of cut Matt loose and said, hey, go find stuff, right? And it didn't give you very much.
Yeah, the parameters were pretty loose.
So give our listeners a sense of a few of the parameters that we talked about.
We wanted to double the dividend return compared to the S&P 500.
Okay, it's just so everybody knows, S&P 500 right now, we used as a proxy to, you know, you can't really invest directly in an index. You have to like buy an index fund or something. So we used an ETF that mimics the index. The ticker symbol was SPY, and we looked at the dividend yield. And the dividend yield on the SPY is 1.3%.
Which you would think it would be a little bit higher. At least I did. I thought it was going to be higher than that. I was surprised to see it was so low.
There are some S&P stocks that have higher dividends, and then there are some that have zero.
Right.
So when you start to average them all out, 1.3 is not outlandish for an all-stock portfolio, much of which is large growth, much of which is technology. A lot of tech companies are reinvesting, so they don't pay dividends.
Yeah.
So it's not outlandish. But we wanted a strategy that was going to pay a dividend, and I said, well, let's start with 2x the S&P yield, right? So it should be higher than 2.6.
Right. So targeting stuff a little bit over 3.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we were also trying to spread that out over different fields. So we're obviously not going to load everything up on energy. We're going to spread
right,
that out.
Right. We didn't want all oil stocks.
Right.
Oil stocks often pay a dividend, or utilities might pay a dividend.
Yeah.
So we didn't want
to
just
own all the same stuff.
We wanted to diversify sectors. Okay.
Yeah. And that was one of the things I was working on today is, spreading that out over energy and food. That was a good stock where you can find a high dividend. And utilities, there's a lot of dividend there. So that was one of the parameters we were looking at.
Okay. And so there was another biggie that is hidden in there for money managers, right? Now, you as an individual investor may be less concerned about this than we are as a manager because we have multiple investors that we're working with, right? And that is liquidity.
Got to be able to get your money back.
Yeah. So the idea is that you don't want to buy something and then not be able to sell it and get rid of it later.
Yeah.
Okay. This is kind of the challenge with real estate. It's not a super liquid asset, right? We understand that you can buy it and you can sell it. It's got tax treatment of long and short-term gains.
But can you sell it tomorrow?
That's the thing, is it can take a while for title to transfer and just the whole process of getting things done.
And I think that's something that maybe not all of our listeners might know either, is that, you know, if you get into a certain stock, it might not be very liquid. If it has a really, really, really low volume, I mean, you might not be able to sell that right away.
So one of the things that we look for is the average daily trading volume.
Yep.
That's the number of shares that trade hands between buyers and sellers in a day. And then we also look at the market capitalization. That's a little less understood.
It is.
Right? But if you consider for a moment that maybe there's a penny stock that trades 5 million shares a day.
But it's only $1.50. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, and well, yeah, let's say it's a dollar.
Sure.
Right? So it's trading $5 million. You come in as an institution and say, well, I'm going to buy $10 million worth of this stock. Well, guess what? You bought all of it, right? You bought all of the daily trading volume. Do you think that's going to skew the supply and demand characteristics of that stock?
Right. Exactly.
You know, and the short answer is there's a very good chance yes. Not a guarantee. Maybe a bunch of other institutions have the same idea, and before you know it, there's a feeding frenzy. But when you have really low volume, that's what tends to move prices more, right? So I had a mentor years ago that talked about what moves the price of a stock. And they said, well, it's the aggressiveness of the buyers or sellers, right? If you consider a stock that has tons and tons of buyers and sellers, and they're all fairly evenly matched up between the number of buyers and sellers, then the price is relatively stable, mm-hmm. right? It's just shares, you know, swapping back and forth. But if there's a real disparity in agreement over price, bunch of people want to sell, but not very many people want to buy, the price can really fall fast if people yeah. are aggressively willing to unload.
Well, and it pains me because I know someone personally who sent me a text message just the other day, and they said, hey, what do you think of this? And they had purchased like 8,000 shares of something. And it was a penny stock by definition.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they had put a ton of money into it and they didn't really know much about it. They had just saw something on YouTube and they're like, oh, I feel really good about this. Boom. They purchase it and they didn't even really know what they had.
Yeah. And this is, if there was a thing that came out of the GameStop phenomenon of the last several months and the meme stocks that have come out of the Reddit trading boards and Wall Street Bets
man.
And all that, it really is gambling.
That's exactly what this was.
Yeah. And so, you know, that's not investing any longer. That's gambling.
Yeah.
Right? And it really drives me bananas because gambling is gambling. It's not investing.
I know, and it gets confused, too. People skew that line so often.
They do. Now, people will say, well, you're just betting on the stock market.
It's much more refined than that.
It is, because if a company is making money, what you're betting on is the future revenues.
Yeah.
And how it's going to be positioned relative to inflation, right? So you're betting on future demand for that. So yes, the economic characteristics matter, but ultimately we've seen like the whole GameStop thing, it stopped being about much of the underlying fundamentals of the company. It became the dynamic of the market, supply and demand, right? The short squeeze. We've talked about that
yeah.
on the show before, where people
Those are
sold
dangerous
a stock
waters.
That didn't, you know, before they owned it. And then if everybody else refuses to sell, right? And then they need to have the price drop in order to buy it back cheaper. If nobody will sell their stock, there's no sellers, then the price can't drop, right? They're
mm-hmm.
all buying and driving it higher and higher and higher.
Scary waters.
That's a short squeeze, right? So as we're looking at this, I want to spend a little time today just talking more about the numbers, the way that we analyze things, and how do we try to get out of our way of how do you shift it from gambling to investing, right?
Ooh.
So there's some of that element today. Like, how do we get out of the gambling and into investing? How do we use the numbers? How do you parse data?
That's something the listeners need to stick around for.
Yeah, they do. But we got to take in our obscene profit break first, so we will do that. And then on the flip side, we're going to unpack a little bit. If you're interested in knowing how do we as pros start approaching the problem solve of investing, that is when we come right back. Stick around. This is Dave Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
And you got True Wealth on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
All right, gang, welcome back to the True Wealth Radio Show. Just a reminder, if you missed all of the quality content prior to our last obscene profit break, it will be available tomorrow on the podcast.
Yes.
Right. So you go to littlejohnfs.com under the Educate tab, and we got a pile of podcasts that go back for years and years. You will, if you listen long enough, you'll hear some of the same stuff. That's how that works. There are also, there's a YouTube channel that you can link in there. Got some stuff where that's where, you know, we get the questions about, hey, can you help out my kid? Right. And so we've got some good videos there to get started for the kids. If they're out, then I guess kids being relative, it's more like young adults. Right. If you're kind of high school age, you know, if you're like six, probably going to be pretty bored. Like, I don't have the Fisher Price video up yet, but yeah, the rest of them. Somewhere about ninth grade or so, probably can latch in. They'll say, like, who's the old dude? I get it. But the content's not bad. Or at least I'm told it's not. Can you self-assess your own content? Are you allowed to do that?
I think you can.
It sounds so egotistical.
Nah.
Like, no, it's pretty good, right? Oh, yeah. No, I'll let you all be the judge. You tell me if it's any good. Okay, so Matt, at the break, we're talking shop about what we do as pros when analyzing risk. And so I'm curious, you're kind of new. You've seen a handful of the things that we are doing. Has there anything that's jumped out at you in looking at the processes as you've seen them with sort of the freshest eyes on the team?
I mean, I don't think people fully understand their real risk score. I mean, that's one thing that we do in shop is we analyze it with a score, right? Mm-hmm. From 0 to 100. And I think a lot of people come in thinking that they're either, you know, super conservative when they might be a little bit more risky with their belief on how they want to invest. And that's one thing I've really noticed lately is that people often don't understand their own level of risk until someone's there to talk it through with them.
Okay. Yeah, that's, and to give everybody listening just a little bit of kind of a breakdown on what Matt's talking about. We do. We grade things. So we grade all the investments that we use on sort of a score between 0 and 100. And it's not what you it maybe initially think. It's not, is it good, bad, or otherwise?
Right.
It's the volatility characteristics, right?
Mm-hmm.
How much upside versus downside do we typically see in a stock? And there is sort of a math process. It's, if you really want to get wonky about it, it's called mean variance optimization.
Ooh.
Yeah. And mean variance, just like it sounds, so mean or the average variability and then optimizing for average variability. Okay, so mean variance optimization, and it's a backward-looking metric. That's the problem, right? Because everywhere you look, it says, remember, past performance is no guarantee of future results. So we do some adjustment internally to try to look at projection scenarios for, well, what would it look like if we saw this additional forward-looking data? How might that change our opinion? But with backward-looking data, we can rank things and say, well, this is what it has done.
Yeah.
Okay? It's a little like driving with a rearview mirror, right? Which is why we're not a purely strategic shop. We are tactical, meaning, good, well, let's try to make some assumptions about forward-looking data. And based on our assumptions and our modeling, can we adjust the outputs?
A little blend of both.
But it's important because what you don't want to do is if you're an investor and you're really conservative, we don't want to get you in investments that don't match how you want to be invested.
Yeah.
But you're right. So what the problem, Matt, is I think not everybody, like their definition of conservative is not necessarily our definition of conservative.
Yeah, that's true.
So you'd go through a risk profiling process where we literally ask a bunch of data-driven questions and get you to say, well, you know, let's look at some trade-off scenarios. Do you like scenario A or scenario B? And you, through testing, we can kind of refine and get somebody to, like, well, we can grade the person and their risk attitude on a scale of 0 to 100 also.
How often when someone takes that test and they see that score, do they say, you know what, no, I don't feel like that test was fully accurate? From what I've seen, most of the time, people are looking at it and saying, yeah, actually, that does feel.
It does a really good job.
Yeah.
There's a lot of academics behind it that have driven it there. But I'd say about 20% of the time, folks look at that. And what happens is they go through the process, then they realize they were trying to game it when they took it.
Oh, that would make sense.
Oh, now that I see that, I want to answer different. And then they retake it, and it's
more
reflective
true.
Of what they want.
That would make sense.
So, you know, that's just different people have different iterative learning processes, I suppose.
Right.
So I think it does a good job of arriving where somebody should be, though.
Yeah, I do too.
And so then we've got them matched up, though, right? Like the investments that we have. So first, it's not an investment, right? We grade every
right.
investment,
it's really
but then we mix
out.
Them together and we grade the composite of all of that. And then we match that to the client's risk score too. So everything sort of aligns. And that's part of that fiduciary process. Well, there are things that I think we as advisors do. And like, here's what I think we do. And I'm curious your thoughts. We did it this morning.
Okay.
Right? Which is we have a committee
yeah.
that reviews things. Why do we do that?
You know, we're protecting the customer, really. We yeah. want to maximize, you know, what they're able to earn while also minimizing that risk. And so we're meeting and we're pouring over each and every investment that we have and making sure, you know, every single week, is this where we want it to be? And I think that's what really, you know, a lot of people don't realize the value in that, because if you're working a 9-to-5, do you have the time or the knowledge to be able to do that on your own? Are you going to be able to sit there and look through these charts and give it that technical analysis? Probably not. And that's why it's really good to have someone in your corner so that they can be handling that for you.
Yeah. And what I like about it is, I mean, the benefit, of course, is from a client perspective, you're getting more than one set of eyes.
Yeah. I mean, right? You've got
there's
four people looking
yeah,
at this.
Yeah, there's a check and balance process. And it's really more than that, too, because we have a whole bunch of other tools and research that are getting yeah. into that. So by the time we're filtering it, it's already survived several iterations of filtration.
Yeah.
But, boy, I keep using the word iteration, huh? Huh. All right. Well, yeah, note to self. Don't keep saying iteration. But the point is that we've filtered it through all this stuff, and then you've got our committee reviewing it as well. And part of what we're trying to do, there's this baggage that we bring to decisions, right? A lot of us don't realize it, but we bring baggage.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And one of there's lots of different studies on this. But the whole field of behavioral finance talks about the embedded biases that we have and how it influences our decisions, right?
For sure.
One of my favorites I've talked about on the program before, the sale-proof stock, right? Anchoring bias. Have you heard of this one?
Yep.
Okay, so you want to explain it to our listeners?
I mean, I think it's where you buy in on a stock and you're just going to stick with it. And kind of like the anchor, it's just dragging you along and you're not letting go of the rope even when you're getting sucked down.
Well, kind of, yeah. So what it is the last part of that, and keep in mind, right, I'm springing these on Matthew, and it's not like you've been a lifelong studier of behavioral finance.
No, it's good. It's good. This is learning for me, too.
This is really pretty close. So we'll just unpack it a little bit more. That it's anchoring to the price you buy something for,
mm-hmm.
right? So we bought it here, and like I paid $20 for the stock, and now it fell to $10. Well, I can't sell it until it gets back to $20.
Yeah.
Okay? Because I don't want to take the loss. I'm anchored to that price. I joke about this, but I'm anchored to the price of a Snickers bar being 40 cents, right? Like, when I was a kid, a Snickers bar was 40 cents.
Do you still avoid buying Snickers because they're not 40 cents?
No, I'm not. Okay. I'm not crazy. It's a Snickers bar here, right? But it's... Yeah, I don't eat Snickers bars much anymore.
They're not 40 cents. I'm not a kid. Eating it.
I can eat that Snickers bar, and it will stick with me for a while. And in 30 minutes, I'll want a nap. But the point is that my anchoring bias is, well, that was the price when I was a kid, so I feel like that's what it should cost. But by that logic, gas should be less than a dollar, too. And today I'm like, oh, man, this gas is ridiculous, right? Mm. But so is a vehicle price.
Yeah.
I can remember when you get a brand new car for under 10 grand, and now I'm like, can you get a car for under 30?
That actually wasn't even that long ago either.
It's crazy how things have shifted. Well, that is the nature of inflation. Don't worry, that's coming. More on that later in the show.
Yeah, stick around.
But the idea is that you anchor to a price, right?
Yeah.
Why is it a sale-proof stock if you're anchored to the price you paid for it?
Because you're not selling it unless the price goes up.
Right, right. Yeah. So the price goes down and you won't sell it. And then if the price comes back, well, why should I sell it? It's making money now.
Oh, I know. It's tough.
So it's like, it's tough. Oh, man. So here's the trick and why we have an investment committee, right? What should you do when it comes to a stock? This is very hard to do, by the way. right? It's really hard to get clinical on this. But what do you do if you have you already own an investment? You're trying to decide whether or not to buy or sell it.
Rephrase that. Where are you going with this?
Well, the easy answer, I don't even want to rephrase it, I'm just going to answer it.
Oh,
right?
Go for it.
Where I'm going for is you need to act like, you need to ask the question backwards. Would I buy it today?
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
Do I want to own the investment today if I knew nothing else about it? If I didn't have it before, would I still want to own it? And if the answer is yes, I still want to own it.
Then keep it.
Yeah. I mean, here's a real world example. Okay. Now, this is not a recommendation. So let me be very, very clear. But we discussed Ford as a company. Now, the discussion, and again, don't go making decisions around whether or not we own Ford. We owned it for a reason. It was complementing other things. Ford's off almost 20% from its highs.
Right.
And so we looked at it and said, well, what do we do? You know, should we keep it or not? And the decision as a committee, which I think I probably drove a lot, by the way.
Well, if it makes you feel any better, I was agreeing with you on this. I just wasn't talking about
it. But, you know, COVID has just completely jacked up
the supply chain.
You can't, they can't sell a lot of vehicles because they're waiting on chips and other things to get them out to marketplace, right? The whole semiconductor shortage and so forth.
But fundamentally, there wasn't a huge check there that was scaring
you
away.
Issue is, so it's come down in price, but now we look at this and say, well, if we liked it before, do we like it more at this price?
Gotcha.
And my answer is, well, actually, yes.
Yeah, your sentiment about the company hasn't really changed.
And keep in mind, this is my long-term case. Again, not investment advice. I'm going to keep beating that drum if regulators listen to this, which is that our premise is that we think there's a transition toward more electric vehicles. And Ford, both Ford and General Motors, are making significant investments
big
in
time
electric vehicle production and research. And we think Tesla was the beta that...
It worked.
They rolled a bunch out, and they started distributing. It's the higher-end, more expensive version. We think Tesla's really interesting for battery technology. Or I do. This is the royal we. I think Tesla's interesting for battery tech. But if you take away a lot of the government incentives, Tesla doesn't really make money. So it's very hard for me to call it an investment in the traditional sense. Again, I'm not advising you one way or the other. I'm just telling you our opinions. And when we look at that versus Ford that has a longer standing track record and more profitability of vehicles, if they're going to pour $30 billion or so into R&D over the next 5 years, we view that as a significant positive for a market where the landscape is changing, and Tesla's already rolled out a lot of the charging stations nationwide. So we see a lot of the backdrop has been sort of set for these other players to come in and be competitive. Doesn't mean they're superior or anything else. Just means very interesting for making it a more broadly adopted technology.
Yeah.
And we wanted to invest in something like that. Not a recommendation for you, again.
But that's a good example for the listeners.
Yeah. So we looked at it and said, price is down. Are we anchored to the price we paid for it? And the answer is, well, we're irritated that we actually are we're lower than we bought it for. So that's a capital loss if we had to sell it tomorrow. But we don't plan to sell it right now because of other reasons. And that's, again, our committee discussion. You may disagree, and, you know, you're free country. You can go do that. That's what makes a market, right? But anyway, we are running a little long. Let's grab a break here, and we'll get back to it. We don't have to talk about anchor bias anymore. We figured that one out. Now we have all new biases. But first, this Obseed Profit Break. Stick around. This is Dave Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
And you're listening to True Wealth on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
Hey, gang, welcome back to the True Wealth Radio Show. Dave Littlejohn in studio with
Matt Dixon.
All right, we're getting our cues down. Love it. So we have been like jamming through today talking about how kind of parsing investments, right?
Mm-hmm.
We don't talk about this a lot. Why it's relevant, I need to give a little bit of backdrop. And the reason is because I think investing is going to get trickier looking forward a little bit.
Really?
I do.
Why is that?
Well, because I think the Federal Reserve, right, the FOMC, Federal Open Market Committee, my sense is that the narrative is beginning to change.
In what way?
Well, the Fed has really backstopped a low cost of capital for our economy for a while now.
It's been, it seems like it's been a while.
That's code for super low interest rates, right?
Yeah.
They have used everything from quantitative easing, which is the actual purchasing of bonds, in some cases the purchasing of stocks or exchange traded funds even, to bolster the market, to keep the demand for U.S. treasuries very, very high. When the demand is high, the price of the treasury stays high, which means the yield stays low. I know that seems weird to people, but there's an opposite relationship between yield and price for treasuries, for fixed income instruments in general, right? And it's because you're making a loan, right? If you want the loan to pay a lot, right? Like if we fixed all the stuff, right? So, hey, I have $1,000 that I give you and it's paying 10%. That's $100, right? That it's going to pay in interest for 1 year, every year, for 30 years, okay? If the new treasury is coming out at $500, pay $100, right? Then you're not willing to pay me $1,000 to buy the old one from me, because you could buy a new one for $500, lower price with the same yield. Then what's going to happen to the one that I already own? For me to unload it to somebody else, to sell it to somebody else, I got to drop the price.
Mm-hmm.
So I drop the price so that my equivalent yield is attractive compared to what's now being offered by the market. Right, the new $500 cheaper version still paying 100. So it went from 10% return to 20%. Well, that cuts my investment pretty much in half. Now, there are other things at play here. We're not going to go into them today. It's, you know, has to do with how soon until the bond matures and everything else. There's a whole pricing methodology to it. Just know that there's an inverse relationship between the price of the bond and the yield. So price goes up, yield goes down. How do you make something more expensive? You get into a bidding war, right? If you want your house to be more expensive, you get lots of people to want to buy it. They get in a bidding war.
Yep.
So that's what the Treasury, that's essentially what the Federal Reserve has done, is, well, let's create a bidding war for treasuries by buying billions, right?
And so, that just can't keep going on
and
forever.
Well, it's not that it can't. I mean, I suppose they could keep doing it recklessly.
Right.
Some argue they already are. But the issue is, if they stop, it changes the supply and demand dynamic of the market.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's less demand and the same supply, the price can begin to drop. Okay,
right.
If the price drops, interest rates go higher on a relative basis. So if interest rates go higher and you go to the bank to take a loan out, it costs you more, which means it's more expensive to borrow. Now, everybody that's going out and buying houses with super cheap mortgages, if the mortgages were twice as expensive, you could buy less house.
Yes.
Right? Because you'd have a higher payment to service the same amount of debt. So it affects it's called the cost of capital. And I'm watching as the Federal Reserve's narrative is changing.
Okay.
Right?
What have you seen recently with the Federal Reserve that's catching your eye?
The phrase transitory.
Ooh.
Yeah. So it's in reference to inflation. Right. The Federal Reserve has sort of said, we believe that inflation is transitory. Now, the Fed has its hands tied a little bit. Right. And they've been tied by Washington, D.C. a little bit, too.
Okay.
And also, this is all right. Here comes controversial statement of the day.
Ding, ding, ding.
Yeah. The CDC. Stay with me here.
We're following.
It connects. Right. And it's not a conspiracy either. It all connects without it being a conspiracy. So the Federal Reserve has a dual mandate. They need to have target unemployment at 5% or lower, and they want target inflation rate of 2%.
Okay.
And so that dual mandate is tricky because you're trying to keep both in balance. COVID throws unemployment way out of whack.
Okay.
Right?
So they're just trying to keep the other one at bay.
So COVID throws everything way out of whack. Congress steps in and says, we will do emergency unemployment, and we will increase the unemployment benefit for everybody that got laid off because of COVID. And so we're going to pay people while they're not working. Okay. Now, that throws off the Fed because now they've got a new wrinkle to work with, right? Well, hey, we have the D.C., Washington, is essentially paying people that aren't working. How do we get them back into the workforce later? That's a challenge, right? Because we've all heard the story about, well, businesses are hiring and wages are going mm-hmm. up. That's a form of inflation, right? Wage inflation.
Is this where your 6% or September 6th is?
That's a big deal, yeah. Right? September 6th. That came up in our investment. Are you going to sell me out about that?
I don't know.
Yeah, it came up in our investment committee this morning. Is my concern is that if we see an extension right. of unemployment benefits beyond September 6th, I view that as a bearish signal for the market. That's my opinion, not investment advice. Mm-hmm. I think it's a bearish signal because...
Well, this correlates to what you're talking about.
It does.
Yeah.
So this is... Now, let me tie in the CDC so you don't think I'm crazy. The CDC issued an extension of the eviction moratorium, which further skews the supply and demand curve for housing, right? And further hampers landlords. The small landlord is getting sort of burned at the stake right now when they can't collect rents but yeah. still have payments on their properties. So there is some really unnatural things going on in the marketplace. Why do we care about evictions and real estate so much? Because it's the majority of the collateral in the banking system.
Yeah.
Okay. So if you have the majority of the collateral in the banking system and it's a cost of capital event, right? Remember,
right.
it's the Fed setting the cost of capital. They are tied together. So that's my concern, is that if we either get an extension of unemployment benefits again, or we get some kind of a continued extension of the eviction rules, or the no eviction rules, those are unnatural interventions in the marketplace.
Yeah.
And it really has the Fed behind the eight ball, because we do see inflation, right? Gas is clearly more expensive. Commodity prices routinely fluctuate. So I don't want to use the price of lumber as it, but the price of housing has clearly gone up dramatically. And if you've been to the grocery store, it's really hard to suggest anywhere that we haven't seen the prices of goods and services in the grocery store go up. They have, because supply is down.
Have a lot of people been defaulting on their mortgages because of the...
I haven't heard about mortgage defaults per se, but...
It would seem like kind of the natural next step if this is extended.
And to some extent, like mortgages, there was some mortgage forgiveness if you qualified. And at one point, they just sort of tacked it on, right? By not paying, what they did was they just pushed it later. So, mm-hmm. okay, I have a 27-year mortgage. I go a year without paying. I still have 27 years when I'm done. But all the interest I should have been
paying
kind of gets
tacked on
at
the end. So we're just piling
that
interest on the back end.
Yes.
Okay.
At least that's my understanding.
I mean, that would make sense. Otherwise, if they didn't do that, everyone that is renting
right.
out their properties is going to be defaulting without those rent payments.
Right.
Yeah.
And so in all of the composite of this picture,
we're just pushing our problems further and further back.
Yeah, kicking the can down the road. Right?
Yeah.
And so we kick
How
the
far
can
down
we
the kick
road
that can?
Financially. And here's the big elephant in the room, right? Something akin to, it's either 20 or 25%, don't fact check me, but somewhere in there, it's a ridiculous number, 20 to 25% of all U.S. dollars in existence in the system have been created in the last 12 months.
Are you serious?
Yeah. Certainly in
That's
the last
alarming.
2 years, right? I mean, it's been a crazy amount of money that we have created through not just quantitative easing, but through like the PPP programs. All of these emergency
packages
were... conjuring it. I don't even call it printing anymore. It's conjuring of money.
Right.
Right. And so that goes somewhere in the system. Right now, the supply chains due to COVID have been interrupted. So you actually have a reduction in supply and an increase in capital.
So do you feel like the inflation numbers aren't truly accurate then to where we're at this moment in time?
Well,
are
this
they lagging?
This is where the language is coming in that needs to be scrutinized. When somebody says, like the Federal Reserve says to me, we think inflation's transitory. What they're saying is, well, we think that it's inflationary now, but we don't think it'll stick around.
Okay.
And here's the bottom line. I disagree. Now you're going to say like, wait a second. You think you're smarter than all these people in the government? I'm like,
or maybe you're just a little bit more clear and
what
factual.
I think is it's a committee making a decision, and they have more than just economics.
They've got an agenda behind
it,
yeah.
Right? There's the political elements that play too, and so yeah, I think their hands are tied. how do we get unemployment up? Well, we can't start raising interest rates now, and we still have people that are getting that aren't in the workforce, and we got supply chains all goofy, and now we have still more issues with COVID, blah, 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 inflation, right? I think it's real.
Oh, yeah.
So that's the concern. Now, does it mean the markets are going to crash? We'll talk about it after our last obscene profit break, because that's the part I think you may be surprised by. But yeah, we got to take this last break. So stick around. We'll be back right after this. This is Dave Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
And you're listening to True Wealth on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
All right, gang, welcome back to the home stretch of the True Wealth Show. Don't forget, podcast at littlejohnfs.com under the Educate tab. And Matt, is the market going to crash?
I don't think it's going to crash. I think it could sidestep a little bit.
And the answer, I don't know. I don't know, but I don't know that the crash may look like what people think it'll look like, right?
Yeah.
This is the acknowledgement. Dear listeners and regulators, this is me making a scientific wild
estimate
guess, right? Swag. We are just going to say, well, you know, what does it mean? And
I think a lot of people are hung up on the COVID stuff right now and Afghanistan. But you had some insight onto that. Do you want to go down that rabbit hole or do you want to sidestep that too?
So, I mean,
I like your opinion on it.
I'll keep it really fast for our listeners.
Okay.
I believe that Afghanistan is truly tragic on a humanitarian level. I don't think the market's looking at it as a significant financial impact.
Yep.
And so I don't want to burden the show or any of our listeners with trying to unpack that. Parts are complicated and then parts of it are just ridiculously simple, right? Like, I just don't get behind the death of women and children for politics.
Period.
So that's pretty easy for me. I really don't get behind the death of people most of the time for that, unless those people only want to win by killing other people, at which point I go, we're going to have trouble talking.
Yeah.
So I don't have a lot of tolerance for intolerance in that respect.
Mm-hmm.
But the rest of it, that seems very simple. So not a need to unpack that much for this show's purpose. Now, the other question about COVID, I think, is more that we're just in it right now. And it's really ugly right now. And I think most of us are getting to a point where for a while, maybe there was a certain amount of civil disobedience because, you know, we're often the minority vote in Roseburg compared to Portland. And so there's a little bit of, hey, you know, I'm kind of anti-government around here. And so we kind of have that, you know, tough attitude about stuff. And because we were really aggressive with protocols, it didn't just burn us at the stake early, but it's here. Right.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I know people that are really struggling. And I've never been a COVID denier. You know, there's a whole complexity to it. But the larger point is,
in regards to the market,
I think the rest of the world, like the rest of the country, isn't experiencing it the way we are experiencing it right here. So our local bias is that we tend to project that everything is this bad, and it's not this bad everywhere. There's spots, but we're pretty bad right now, and it's tough. And for those that are struggling and directly affected by it, you know, genuinely, thoughts and prayers are with you. So I don't want to trivialize that, nor do I want to politicize it. That is what it is. But at the market and the way things are working, I think we're getting to the other side of this thing, because I think a lot of people, I don't think the models haven't gotten it very right lately, right? So that's my issue. Here's my bigger issue, right?
Okay.
I don't know that a market crash looks like a market crash the way we traditionally think of it. Like, oh, the stock market just fell by 25% or something like that. We start locking stuff down unexpectedly. That can happen, right? That really could.
Mm-hmm.
We don't do that, though, and we kind of press on with what we're seeing now. My larger concern is inflation could really take off and we could see real loss of purchasing power. Stock market kind of stays flat, but everything else around us gets more expensive. And you've effectively just lost your purchasing power, right? You're not keeping up with inflation. So you are experiencing a loss, but you don't see it in the form of a big market correction. That could happen. Essentially, it's everything inflating, but the market not inflating as fast as everything else.
Right. But
it's
no
a
more
phantom crash, right?
Yeah.
So I think we really could see that because markets kind of love irony. And, I think the joke that at any given time, the markets will do whatever they can to prove the most number of people wrong at once. So everybody's kind of saying, oh, it's got to crash, right? You go, no, it doesn't. But we could look back in 2 years and say, oh, I see what happened there.
Yeah.
Right. You know, everything doubled in price. Gas is now $4 a gallon and milk is $5 a gallon. And my investment portfolio is the same as it was 2 years ago. Oh, that's real, right? That could really happen. So that's the part that I keep an eye on is what if a crash doesn't look like a crash? You know, we keep thinking, well, what if all of my stocks fall? What if they don't, right? What if they just don't go up? So what's our solve?
What do you mean, what's our solve?
Yeah. What do you do as investors, right? What does everybody need to do? And the answer is seek qualified advice. If we are truly going through an inflationary environment, you want to own assets that will inflate. And that's really simple. Own assets, not liabilities. Okay. Turns out that's pretty good advice all the time. Assets tend to go up in value. Liabilities do not. So load up the balance sheet the right way. Make good decisions. And the number one rule in finance, spend less than you make.
I like that.
Right? Pretty easy there. Spend less than you make and you can go far. But as you can tell, that is the music. So we are out of time. If you would like to take a look at your investment options or are looking for advice or help, feel free to give us a call. Matt, have you memorized the number?
No.
Uh-oh. Well, 541-375-0898. So we're out of time for now, but thanks for tuning in. Until next time, this has been David Littlejohn
and Matt Dixon.
And you've been listening to True Wealth on News Radio 1240 KQEN.